So I want to kind of just finish up with talking about some of the relational Dharma principles, you know, how we can take the clarity, the wisdom, the kindness off of our cushion and into our relations. And then we'll kind of begin, we'll see how time allows, scratching the surface of the eco-crisis and, you know, how we're doing with it and what's our response. Again, the backdrop is if we want to be effective in taking action, we need to really be skillful in how we relate, because relationship is everything. We can't effect change without being skillful at relating to others. And we've talked about how our practice itself is relational practice, and not just relational practice, but the essence of relational practice. We talked about all the qualities that mindfulness is training in us: patience, listening, non-judgment, knowing what's happening, being open to what's happening without being swept away by it. You know, if you can think of relating to someone and having all those qualities. So someone's having a big drama, and it's not helpful to them if you're swept away in their drama. What's helpful if you're really kind and really attentive and really listening to how it is for them without yourself sort of, quote-unquote, drowning with them. And mindfulness is training in all of that. And then we know also that mindfulness is using the circuitry of the brain that gets developed through healthy attachment in childhood. We're using the social circuitry of the brain with mindfulness. It is relational practice. And so all we need to do is then translate what we learn on the inside into our outer relationships. So it's really not doing anything different except being able to take it outside. And so that's why our practice has this focus of inner and outer. So you're already practicing relationship, especially with inner and outer awareness of both. And then when we're, as you all are saying, there's a lot more stimulus with outer. And then we have the stimulus of noticing not just each other, but noticing the environment and noticing our thoughts about what we're doing to the environment. And so we can't wall ourselves off in some way from the world through our practice. We might need to do it sometimes, but eventually we need to come out. And so this series is just about that. And so then when we take the kind of inner wisdom outside, you know, there's some really simple principles that just are going to really help us relate. And one which we talked about is taking responsibility for our experience, because we see clearly that how we're doing depends on us. Things can happen to us, but what happens inside is our responsibility. So we take responsibility for ourselves rather than projecting outwards our experience. And so that's sort of the second principle. When we take responsibility and we own what's ours, you know, no one can make us angry. What makes us angry is our own history, values, assumptions, etc. So when we take responsibility, we also own our projections. We don't assume that because I'm this way, someone else is this way too. We notice our projections and we practice the sort of 80-20, which you can do if you want as you're listening. It's a really good Dharma practice. Most of your attention as you listen is awareness of body. And we're aware of the body as our inner, because it's the more reliable guide. Our thoughts and images are wackadoodle and is where all of our ego and personality is based. The body is the least conditioned part of you. It's the part least run by your personality. So we listen to sensation as a strong aid to relating well. It's an ironic thing. The more self-aware we are, the better we can relate to others. It's not the self-awareness of narcissism. And remember, only you can stop narcissism. Right? So it's very important. You're very important. It's not the self-awareness of narcissism. It's the self-awareness that doesn't actually make a distinction between self and other. It's just, we just either direct it here or we direct it there. It's the same awareness. So we own our projections through this practice of self-awareness, especially the body. So that's kind of reviewing what we've done. And we looked at the inside dialogue practice and we started doing the first three steps. Anyone remember what those are? It's a structured way of being mindful. There was three steps. Yeah, so the first is pause, which is what? If you weren't here last week, you... Pause is awareness. It's like an inner inventory. Awareness of what's happening inside. So let's pause right now together, but with eyes open. What's happening inside? What sensations obvious? And then notice, is there a thought or an image that's obvious? This is pause. And the second step is relax. With relax, we're still inwardly focused. We notice anywhere there's tension. And anywhere in the body there's tension, we invite it to relax. And with relax, very important, relax the eyes. We get very, like, goggle-eyed, right? Very tunnel vision with the eyes when we relate. The relaxing is an incredibly helpful relational tool. And part of relax, which we didn't cover last week, is noticing space. Well, we did kind of cover that. We just didn't put it into this. So, space. So your eyes are relaxed, but the gaze is not out of focus. The gaze is very sharp, but the eyes are relaxed. And you can be aware of space as part of the relaxed thing. And if that's hard to be aware of space, you don't want to add struggle right here, so don't worry about it. Just keep relaxing. And then open is where our awareness now is inner and outer. Aware of sensation, thought, or image inside, sight and sound outside. And then there's, so this is the presence aspect of insight dialogue. And again, it's developed by Gregory Kramer, coming out of his insight meditation practice, that inner practice. Oh, how do we take this outer? Well, this is his form of it. And in his form, you know, when you do retreats with Gregory, you're doing a lot of your meditation in dyads, in conversation. And it's really interesting. You might have noticed this. When you're talking to somebody, you stay focused. The social norm isn't that we get to sort of like sit here with each other and just, you know, space out, right? There's actually concentration built into the conversation. And what all we did last week was we did I'm aware of, which is the easiest way to talk to somebody and stay mindful. If all you're saying is I'm aware of, did you notice that? You can actually stay here in the room with each other. So this is the presence aspect of insight dialogue. And then the next part is more the dialogue part, and that's more like exploring something, some topic that you're going to kind of chew over together, explore together. And that's, so you're going to kind of dialogue about something, and it's a way of talking deeply about something. And so tonight, our dialogue's going to be around just how we're doing in relation to the eco-crisis. Maybe just hearing the phrase eco-crisis, you have a lot coming up inside. And so the inside dialogue is going to just help us, like, support each other as we are aware of how we're doing, even just to face this topic. And so this part of inside dialogue is, in, you know, how do we guide the actual speaking and listening? And so the first principle is trust emergence. Trust emergence simply means staying in the moment. Trust whatever is happening for you right now and whatever you're listening to right now. And the most common way we break contact is to rehearse when we're listening. And then to recriminate after we've spoken. Can't believe I said it. Or I said it that way. Or, I hope that didn't land in the wrong way. I hope they know what I meant. Right? And so that's a way of breaking contact. So trusting emergence is being willing to just stay in the moment with the other person and letting go of rehearsing, letting go of recriminating. And then the fifth principle is speaking truthfully. And this is a huge topic. What does it even mean to speak truthfully? What is the truth? And when we explore thinking mind, and there's a basic flaw built into all thinking, and that is that we're thinking about something. When you have a sensation in the body, it's simple and clear, throb, pulse, tingle. It isn't about something. It's just its own thing. When you see something, hear something, taste something, smell something, there's no about in it. But thinking is about something. Meaning, by definition, thoughts can never be the actual thing. A sensation is just what it is. A thought is not. A thought can be 1,000% divorced from reality, or it can be corresponding to reality. It can never be reality in the sense that we're symbolizing reality. And so there's all kinds of errors we make by symbolizing things. Now, thoughts happen, the symbolizing is real, but we mistake the symbol for what we're symbolizing for reality. We mistake it. So your thinking mind, so if we go to what's true, it's very tricky. So from all that, and this is very important for any kind of, political, social engagement, dialogue, to understand that our thoughts and our opinions are limited. We can't completely capture reality with any thought, much less a thought about which social system is the best one, you know. And so we don't want to throw out thoughts, but what we want to orient to more is thoughts are not so much true or not true, but useful or not useful. It's a really helpful switch in our relationship with our thoughts. It can't be completely true, because no thought is. But is it useful? It's a really powerful question to bring to any thought that's stressing you out. Is it useful? Sometimes our stress-inducing thoughts are useful. If we could figure out a way to have those thoughts without the stress, that would be really good, but sometimes we can't. And so to speak truthfully is to have this wisdom of mindfulness, and mindfulness shows us all the time that our thoughts are just, big stories about things, and often they don't even come close. Sometimes they can come close. And we want to value the thoughts that do. And the Zen tradition has a saying, a finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So, now, if the moon is over there, and I'm like, look at the moon, but the moon's over there, that's a very unhelpful thought. If I say, look at the moon, and the finger points at the moon, your thought corresponds to reality. It's actually pointing at something. So we're not trying to throw away all thoughts. We get that the thought 2 plus 2 equals 7 is not useful. 2 plus 2 equals 4, useful. Helpful. The theory of evolution, as far as we can tell, is a very useful way to think about life. It's the closest, from a scientific viewpoint, finger we've got for like the journey of life, you know. Creationism as a finger is not necessarily pointing at something that we can identify easily. It's sort of pointing at its own ideology. So again, you know, if you have a Christian background, I don't mean to cause offense or incite you too much. I'm just saying this is the scientific viewpoint. From the scientific viewpoint, evolution is the most useful thought we have for understanding how life is here, the way it is. So, some thoughts are better than others in the sense that they correspond better to how things are. But to think that what you're thinking is true and someone else's thoughts are false is a real arrogance that's not based on the wisdom of mindfulness. Because mindfulness sees uncertainty, complexity, change, and so many ways thinking about something can't capture the thing. The about-ism, you know, is the flaw just of any thought. You're already screwed if you're having a thought in that way. So again, thoughts can have relative truth or usefulness, but in an absolute sense, they're just symbolizing something. So to take this all back now to speaking truthfully. Speaking truthfully would mean, what I'm talking about is a more cognitive level. You know, our thoughts sort of cognitively true. And I'll speak to other levels. So cognitively, we add in uncertainty. We add in nowness. This is how it is now, because we know things can change. You know, we get it that, you know, we might say, I think it's like this. You know, you're kind of adding in that way. That's a way of being more truthful with speaking. Being really black and white in your opinions isn't very truthful. An emotional way of being truthful is to just speak your vulnerability. You know? Speak what feels a little edgy or risky or tender. And guys, you know, we have this conditioning. It's very confusing to be raised male and to have vulnerability, because we all do. You know, we don't even, like, in a way, know how to gender it. It doesn't feel like it's part of our gender necessarily. So, sometimes we as men are more challenged in the vulnerability department and even knowing that we have vulnerability. So we could say that the insight dialogue, where you're just naming your present moment experience, can take you to vulnerable places. And that's why in the group, you know, this is confidential. That's why, like, your regular attendance is really helpful, because we all get to know each other. We can feel safer with each other. We can go deeper together. But speaking truthfully is not an edict. It's like, thou shalt always confess your deepest, darkest secret to whoever walks along. It's not that kind of... It's the self-respect to know what feels like a risk you want to take, and when it feels like, you know, I'm it's too edgy, and that's up to you, you know, to self-select. And that's an act of awareness. It's not a repression or suppression or falsity. It's really just a knowing yourself. There's a funny cartoon. This goes to the mansplaining thing about, you know, we want to talk and relate, and making sure that, you know, we can teach somebody something. So a man and a woman are standing outside her door, and she's got her hand on the doorknob, and she's saying, "I'd love to ask you in, Howard, but I need some time to digest everything you told me about the Ottoman Empire." How's that for a first date? So, and we can break true contact that way, you know. And this is really important, then, with listening. With listening deeply, this is easy, because we're already practicing deep listening with our practice. And the spiritual teacher Sri Sai Baba said, "Before speaking, ask yourself, will it improve the silence?" Our listening communicates something very deep. It means you're communicating you're worth listening to. Your silence, your listening, your interest communicates so much. And it communicates non-judgment. Someone can just say what they want to say. And this really bears, as we go into thinking about ecological issues and what we might want to do about it and how we might feel about the political climate right now, you know, are we going to take respectful, interested, curious listening into a conversation with someone who thinks differently than you? And what if you think they're really wrong? And what if you think we only have 11 years to make a dramatic change? How are you going to relate to someone who doesn't agree with you around the climate crisis? And, you know, I taught a day long, and someone came up to me and said, "My wife doesn't come to Buddhist retreats in Boulder anymore because there's always the assumption that there's no Republicans in the room." So, you know, do we want a spirituality that doesn't allow for that? And, you know, our edict of love everyone in this practice, and there's at Columbine Unity Church, where I lead day longs, there's a great little poster. It says, you know, love everyone. Love those who don't speak like you, act like you, think like you, look like you, love like you, pray like you, vote like you. So this listen deeply piece, yeah. You know? And how can we do that while we oppose what we feel is harmful? And so that would be a big inquiry. And the big thing is we oppose actions. We don't oppose people. We oppose views. We oppose actions. We don't have to oppose people to work for justice, fairness, etc.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that? Oppose actions?
Yeah. Actions
I have
views.
A problem with that.
Yeah. Well, what's if you know whatever you're thinking about? The issue is not the person, unless you know a person directly has caused you great harm, but it's their action that causes harm, and you want to oppose the action.
Okay.
You don't have to oppose the person while taking strong action to oppose what you feel is harmful. You don't have to oppose a person. It's a view that you might feel is harmful, an action of speech, an action of body. In the Buddhist context, those are the three actions, body, speech, and mind. So there's ideologies that are harmful, there's speech that's harmful, and there are physical actions that are harmful. We can oppose every one of those and still not oppose the people behind the actions.
Okay.
And we're going to spend a lot of time with that.
Okay, fair enough.
When we... Yeah, no, it's a really important question.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Because when we oppose people, we assume they're crazy, they're stupid, they're sociopaths, whatever. I mean, we have all kinds of views that prevent us from listening to how people actually are. Right? I mean, do we want to contribute to polarization? Or do we want to contribute to listening and understanding while fighting for what we believe in?